Politics at the accession of George III. George III's reign is characterised by a number of new factors. The end of a period of stability and peace on the international scene, in particular the coming of the American War of Independence and the French Revolution. Economic change, urbanisation and improved communications, which give a different economic and social character to Britain after 1760. The growth of evangelical religious fervour, both within the Church of England and in the dissenting groups, of which Wesleyan Methodism is the strongest. An increase in radicalism on the political scene. These changes can be summarised by what Paul Langford has called the birth of sensibility, by which he regards the search by the emergent middle classes in Britain for a code of manners challenging the aristocratic standards of the day. George III's reign has long been used as a watershed by historians. For example, it's argued that his reign inaugurates a new system of government, or alternatively revives an old system in which the crown has greater responsibility. Contemporary politicians, from Wilkes to Burke, accuse the king of behaving in an unconstitutional manner. And it's clear that his vision of kingship is very different from that of his predecessors. For example, in an essay he wrote in 1758, he argued, "A prince will be feared and respected abroad, adored at home by mixing private economy with public magnificence. He will silence every clamour, be able to apply proper remedies to the heavy taxes that oppress people, and lay a sure foundation for diminishing the enormous debt that weighs this country down." His reign does inaugurate a decade of inherent instability in the high political arena. Many of these factors which cause this instability are external. For example, period of war with France, the lack of suitable candidates to fill the top posts, and skirmishes between Britain and her colonies. However, the prince's desire that he should usher in a new virtuous era of politics once he became king were dashed. Instead, he replaced one corrupt type of politics, that is, ruled by oligarchy, with another, ruled by the king's favourite. He was determined to get rid of the old Whigs, in particular Newcastle, who was Prime Minister on his accession. And in May 1762, Newcastle resigned after almost 40 years of continuous office and was replaced by George III's former tutor and favourite, Lord Bute. Not content with installing Bute in office, George III carried out revenge attacks against the old Whigs, removing them from all their offices, the so-called Massacre of the Pelhamite Innocents. However, Bute's period in power did not last for long. There was a great deal of suspicion in the country and in the House surrounding his position, and he increased his unpopularity by the introduction of a cider tax in 1763, which provoked rioting in London and the cider counties. Bute did continue, however, to play an influential role behind the scenes. He was replaced by a more conservative ministry headed by Grenville. Grenville's ministry was characterised by conservatism, economy and efficiency. America continued to be a problem, and the government took a high-handed approach to the Wilkes affair, which we will discuss in a later lecture. Again, the instability meant that George III had no choice but to remove Grenville and was faced by the perennial problem of who would replace him. Pitt would not step into the gap, and thus, having no alternative, the king turned to Lord Rockingham in 1765. Rockingham was a very rich Yorkshire magnate, acceptable to the old Whig establishment, but at the same time injecting some country opinion into the traditions of aristocratic Whiggism. He represented then an alliance between the rump of the old core Whigs and a younger, more ambitious group. He possessed a brilliant propagandist in Burke, and even though only briefly in power, he managed a clean sweep of the offices of state, about 30 to 40 changed hands. He also stamped his mark on American policy. However, it was no surprise, considering the distrust between the Rockinghamites and the king, that as soon as possible George III replaced Rockingham with Pitt, who had now become the Earl of Chatham. Pitt also faced troubles immediately on the foreign stage. There were splits in the administration's own ranks over the continuing issue of America and the abuses of the East India Company. Pitt was forced to turn to conservatives to shore up the administration, and there was a decided move to the right. Pitt's administration then was generally considered to be a disaster and bedevilled by rifts. The Wilkes affair was resurrected in 1768-9, which gave the Rockinghamite opposition a new lease of life, and eventually Pitt resigned. George III's attempts then to destroy party by divide and rule had failed. There are a number of issues which have been discussed by historians in this period. In particular, was there a revival of Toryism? Historians such as Namier, Brooke and Clark have emphasised the continuity between the politics of the reigns of George II and George III, whereas historians like O'Gorman, Brewer and Hill see new elements in the structure of politics. Those who argue that there's a new Toryism point to issues such as the treatment of Wilkes, the use of the general warrant, libel cases. They see the position of the king as an active force in politics and as an essential element in the revival of Toryism. And they argue that the so-called party of the king's friends became a counterbalance to the Whiggism of the Rockinghamite party. However, was this Toryism anything new? Was it anything more than just a mere conservatism? It's very difficult to see the Tories emerging as a particular party in this period. The other debate is centred around the role of the Rockinghamites in the 1760s and 1770s. The leading historian in this field is Frank O'Gorman, who has argued that the Rockinghamites have definite claims to be forerunners of the 19th century Whig Party. They have leaders, they have an ideology, they have party policy, they have a brilliant theorist and propagandist in Burke, and they achieve a clean sweep of offices at the top of Parliament when they're in power. In sum, O'Gorman argues that the Rockinghamites gloried in party principles and stood for party government, advocating party politics. The Rockinghamite Whigs do form an opposition, but are they really the forerunners of the 19th century Whig Party? There are other groups that could make a claim to that role. After all, they're in power for less than a year, and for many of their years in opposition, they are weak and disunited. In conclusion, then, this period is one of intense instability and uncertainty in politics. Although there are elements of party conflicts, and there is a polarisation between Rockinghamites on the one hand and the King's friends on the other, this is not to admit the emergence of a two-party politics. The period, though, does see the failure of the traditional form of personality or factional politics. George III's attempts to annihilate party only succeed in bringing about the crystallisation of party, in particular the grouping around the Rockinghamites.